Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable here with Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office and now a manager on our SIU team, and Matt Kuchanski, retired executive from HHS OIG and then went on to run the Northeast UPIC and is now the director of our SIU team, and Jason Eisengrind is still on his Sailing the Seven Seas PTO. I think we expect him to be back next week. So we'll be back at full strength, as they say in hockey, after a power play, full strength. So
great game last night.
There was a game the other night. Yeah. The Rangers had a homecoming, which is going to be this coming week. So it'll be all right. So today we want to close out the month of May talking about some of the things that we've been having in sort of our themes for this week's podcast. We want to talk about transformation and modernization and transforming an SIU into kind of that global payment integrity. And really, you know, part of this is the ongoing discussion. There's kind of two things that are ongoing discussions, which is providers getting into in-network programs, in-network plans that maybe should not have been in, right? There's kind of the two categories. There's the providers that get in and they don't have malintent when they get in, but they suddenly turn a corner and become wayward providers and get into some sort of malfeasance. And then there's the group of providers that are intending on bilking health insurers, whether it be Medicare, Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial insurers. And from the get-go, they have that as the intent, and that sometimes is the challenge. So, you know, number one is always going to be working on the high-risk providers, right? High-risk providers are generally going to be your DME, your home health, and things of that sort. And, you know, OIG puts out a list of criteria for high-risk providers, and they even have a list of providers who they consider to be extraordinarily high-risk but still remain in the program. And, you know, so Matt, I want to start with you because this is one of those kind of interesting things where, you know, you've got, you know, I'm sharing my screen where you've got these instances where HHS OIG has the fraud risk and heightened scrutiny calculations, right? They've got kind of, has a provider been excluded? Is there a provider that's under a corporate integrity agreement? You know, obviously you're very low risk if you've done a self-disclosure because you've already admitted that you've had a problem. You've had some, clearly you've had some corporate integrity agreement in place that's provided some greater scrutiny in and of itself. But more likely than not, when you have a self-disclosure, it's because you've got a good compliance program in place and you've been able to identify these issues. But the one thing that I thought was really interesting when I went up on this website, and I think when I showed this to you, Matt, before we got on the recording, you did exactly what I did, was you raised your eyebrow because there's a list of parties under heightened scrutiny, which is, you know, parties are subject to heightened scrutiny because they refuse to agree to integrity obligations. And so there's a list of these providers that go back to 2018. And, you know, it kind of begs the question of, if they had this issue, why are they in the program? And, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get an answer to that, but obviously it falls into the category of, you know, what does CMS do? There's something called the APS, Advanced Provider Screening, and that's a tool that's mostly automated to do constant monitoring of things. And it's an evolution. There's constantly new databases that are being added, but it's not exhaustive, and providers start into the program and it ends up where maybe there's some malfeasance. But, you know, Matt, when you were at the UPIC, you know, this was an ongoing thing. It's like, how did this provider get in the program? And, you know, we're going to talk to Wade in a minute about the change of ownership and some of the scrutiny that doesn't happen with that or that does. But this is an ongoing issue. And clearly on an SIU or the plan side, and particularly the UPIC, this is an ongoing thing that becomes an issue, is how did this provider get into the program?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the history of CMS, you know, mid-60s, you know, that was, it was revolutionary to have a government-run healthcare program for a particular part of the population. And the biggest worry of HCFA at that time was getting providers to actually participate. You know, they needed to do anything they could to get the providers into the program. Yeah, and that's the mid 60s. Yeah. Now, that mindset still seems to be the same for CMS, even though the program now is so large and such an integrated part of the healthcare system, providers have to be part of Medicare and Medicaid to be able to run a successful practice. But the mindset of CMS is still the same. We need to do everything we can to bring in and keep the providers in the program. It's they see that the enrollment and the membership of a provider almost as a right of the provider to be a member of the Medicare system or the Medicaid systems, as opposed to it being a privilege. You know, it's a program that should be very, very careful about who it brings in, but it's really not. We had cases in the UPIC where a provider would have dozens of different UPINs, provider billing numbers, because if you took action on one, they had another one in reserve that they would just start billing on, undetected by the program integrity units. And CMS allowed that to happen because they wanted to keep the providers happy. You know, and I've said this before, but if you look at the CMS COOP plan, there, you know, if CMS is blown up in a bomb by a bomb, number one priority, keep the money going to the providers. That is their number one priority. It always has been, always will be. And that compromises the upfront efforts to, you know, to have some quality assurance at the front gate of the program. You know, you've got APS and all that, but I think it all is still geared toward getting them in as fast as possible with as little difficulty as possible.
Right. You know, and the thing that's interesting is if a provider is attempting to get into a network, non-governmental, they're trying to get into, you know, some commercial payer or what have you. Because if that provider is already in Medicare's network, then they have passed muster through PECOS, which flows into what's known as APS, Advanced Provider Screening. So I think that a commercial plan is probably obviously not doing as robust of a review as APS would do, because they don't have the same level of ability to do that work. But it certainly doesn't mean that the credentialing team from a payer shouldn't be looking to do as much scrutiny as they can. So like Wade, right? There are lots of tools out there where the commercial payers can go in and, you know, not that we're subscribing to anyone or another, but, you know, there's tools that are out there that are run by different companies that kind of bring all of the different data sets into place, right? You've got things like Clear and Accurint and LexisNexis and things of that sort, which, you know, you can go in and at least do things like provider verification of licensure and things like that. But those are really just tools. You still need to take an independent review. The fact that LexisNexis or Clear or one of those tools has the ability to identify that Wade McFall has an active license in the state of California, that doesn't mean that you should take it at face value. You should be going on to that state's website, doing some of that. But it's a similar thing when you talk about like change of ownership, right? CHOW, which comes out of, in the Medicare world, PECOS, provider enrollment and change of ownership system, that information is as good as it is. And one of the big issues that comes out of things like PECOS and change of ownerships is it's not a new entity. So the level of scrutiny may not be as robust as it could be.
Right. And as we discussed earlier, it's like the biggest workaround, because you have all these things in play to initially get a provider number approved. You have PECOS, you have APS, you have upfront screening, and then you come along with this change of ownership, and it really is just an end around, because it's avoiding all that. It's a new entity. You're just changing the ownership, but they're not redoing all those tests and checks and balances that they do when the original provider number is issued. So it's always been, you know, in the Medicare fraud investigations, it's always been one of those things that we look at and say, how can this possibly be? It's just like it's written for the, as you said, the ones who it's not the providers who have no ill intent. It's the ones who, I mean, that's like a tool that they use to get around it. So it's like really unfortunate.
Is it still true that they cut paper checks to the new owners if they haven't done their EFT forms in the meantime? I've seen cases involving paper checks being cut by CMS to these new owners that they then take to cash check cashing places and avoid any scrutiny by the banks and things like that.
No, I thought that there was something that was out, and we could follow up and talk about this again next week, but I thought that there was something that was put out about as part of like the Paper Reduction Act and things of that sort, where it's only EFT that's done through, right, EFT, electronic funds transfer, which is done after an EDI, electronic data interface, right? You're agreeing to submit your claims electronically, and therefore you're agreeing to take payments electronically. I don't know if that's the case. You know, there's obviously the ability to retroactively bill from the date of application once you've been approved, but that allows you to do electronic submissions of claims.
I think that changed around 2017 because we had a big case in Los Angeles where it was a provider identity theft case where they were cutting these checks to these doctors that they do a change of ownership, people that had nothing to do with the doctor. They would get a change of ownership and have a like just a mailbox, and then they would get these, you know, Medicare numbers from, you know, cappers and patient lists, submit claims for things that blatantly weren't done, but now they have a paper check written out to doctor whoever, and they have to cash it. And that's where we came in. We had like money laundering inside the bank kind of person. So it was a big deal in 2016, 2017. I think it changed shortly after that.
Yeah. And not to belabor this or get too far off topic, but, you know, recently there were a bunch of cases that were out there with unscrupulous individuals who were sending, EFT redirect forms to payers. So payers were getting a change of bank routing information, and money was going out the door. And you know, we worked on a few cases here on the SIU team where some of our SIU clients were getting hit, where payments went out the door. We helped them tighten up some of those policies on some additional scrutiny that when a provider submits a form seeking to change their bank account, that there were going to be some manual processes put in place to do that, so that didn't really happen. But, you know, look, there's obviously some basic scrutiny that an SIU or a plan from the enrollment can check, right? You've got your list of excluded individual and entities. You've got preclusion checks that you can do. You've got your high-risk provider lists that you can check. You've got things like ensuring that the provider has a current license in the state that they're claiming to have that current license. And license, by the way, isn't just for medical providers, right? License to do business, departments of banking and insurance may have things like that, State Department of State, LLCs, that individual providers can, you know, where that you can check for things like that. So there are some tools out there, but, you know, keep in mind that one of the biggest issues is if a provider is hell-bent on getting into that program and they're trying to do it in an unscrupulous manner, they're going to take whatever steps they have to hide things like true ownership and things like that, particularly when you've got the prospect of change of ownership where you're not looking to get in as a new provider, because you've got existing contracts and things of that sort. So, you know, the one thing that I always put out there is that no matter how good a payment integrity program is, no matter how good a credentialing group is, I mean, you know, CMS invests tens of millions of dollars a year on advanced provider screening, which is a very robust and complex system of checks and balances. Bad providers get in all the time, and it's not from there not being constant monitoring. It is just that, you know, the unscrupulous providers take really strong steps to hide or obstruct the true ownership. I mean, it's no different than when providers are misrepresenting a service. If that service is a clean claim, it's going to get paid. And, You know, you're years later, you're trying to figure it out. But, you know, clearly provider groups can do or payers can do what they can to transform and modernize their systems to at least start to look at things in ways that maybe they didn't and re-review things that are out there. You know, if a provider gets a settlement agreement with the government or a provider is indicted for fraud, waste, abuse, is the payer going back, which is where we get to this, like, are you trolling press releases? Are you getting a dump of press releases on a daily basis for providers who have been indicted, have pleaded guilty, have entered into civil settlement agreements? You know, are you going up onto the OIG's civil settlement page for corporate integrity agreements? Are you looking at those things, particularly for things like civil monetary penalty law cases, where there may not be a press release, U.S. Attorney's Office is not involved in those, right? So it's some of that, and you've got to be able to do that. Are you bringing in an intelligence analyst to take a look at these things and identify, you know, those kind of things, which then kind of gets to the other piece of that, which is that when you've got a provider who's been involved with that, have you put that provider on your radar? And therefore, are you looking at providers in that individual group? But then also, are you categorizing your cases properly? So Wade, you know, back to you on this, because when you're looking from a payment integrity perspective, grouping cases becomes important. Are you grouping cases by provider type? Are you grouping cases by criminal and civil? When you've got a recovery, how are you grouping those, right? You've got savings, you've got recoveries, you've got restitution, you've got recoveries that come in from audits. Being able to categorize those cases really helps you in understanding where your ROI is and helps you in figuring out where you need to be looking if you're not looking.
Right. And I think that's the probably the most common way to group them is by the type of case. If it's a restitution recovery, that's where your ROI comes in. I've seen a lot of, you know, where, and we've talked about this too, but my focus early on coming from the IG's office was more looking towards trying to get criminal referrals. And I think a lot of the plans, that's not as important as the ROI of just getting recoveries. So you have to not only track them all separately, but you have to be on the same page as far as what's the priority. What do you want from this? You want recoveries over referrals to law enforcement, and it's another whole other, you know, conversation, because a lot of times you work up a referral, you send it off, and it sits for, you know, months or years. And we were guilty of that with the OIG's office. We get referrals and it takes a long time to work them up. But if a payer is looking for, you know, monthly, you know, tracking stuff monthly and getting those recoveries and restitutions, a case that goes off as a referral and sits for a couple of years is, like we were talking about before, that's an ROI killer, because it's dormant. And then when you get it back, maybe it's so old that some of those claims are no longer, you know, you're not able to recover them because maybe they're 4 years old, 5 years old now. So going back to the question, though, I think it is important that you track all those different categories: recoveries, restitutions, referrals. Maybe there's sometimes it's just an education. It might be a minor thing that's not really, it turns out not to be fraud, and it's more of an educational thing where they're just using the wrong codes and they just need to be educated after, you know, a CPC review, and just basically get them back on track.
Yeah, and actually we just had that happen recently. We have one of our payer clients. We did a review and there was a 100% error rate with a zero overpayment because the provider was documenting their services. They just were using the wrong code. And when you actually looked at what the right code was, it had no effect on payment. 100% an error on the provider side, but it's really an education point, right? If the provider just knew the right, they were just billing the wrong code. It was an audiologist and they were just billing the wrong code. And it was very clear. It was a very well, our auditor said it was a very well documented service. They were just billing the wrong code. And when you looked at the correct code, there was no effect on payment. It reimbursed at the same rate. So it was really, it's really an education piece. And we're actually getting ready to do like a 30-minute education with the provider just to be able to explain to them, hey, look, it's absolutely an education issue, on that. So yeah, that's a piece of the puzzle. And that has to do with ROI, because in the future, does that become something that an SIU immediately looks at and sends back to payment integrity for training and education? Maybe you don't do a full review. You look at it, you just get a couple of records and kind of figure it out. So Matt, I want to go to you as we, kind of run to the end of the time on this. Is one of the biggest things has to do in this, in our space now, and it was a big thing at the OIG, it's a big thing on the UPIX, is this premise of projected savings. And how do you project savings on something? You know, my favorites are when the provider makes an overpayment on something that was caught after the fact, and then you're trying to project out, what's the savings? Well, it's very difficult. It's kind of, how do you calculate that? If the provider did what they did for 3 years and they have $1 million overpayment, do you project out 3 more years and say the projected savings is $1 million? Because you have no other benchmark to make. But what if you caught the provider at year 4 or year 2 or whatever? And I think there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of debate, and every plan will have their own calculus of what they consider projected savings. I was just looking at NHCA puts out a yearly analysis and return on investment on some surveys that they do, but it's all over the place. Everybody will project savings in different ways. I've seen some plans project savings based upon money that they stop going out the door. I've seen others project savings based upon billed amounts, right? Not actual amounts. There's like a million metrics. And then, so the question becomes, is there really a methodology that you can employ? And then even if you did, how far out do you project savings on something that's, kind of a crystal ball?
It is very complex. And as you said, there's no set definition for any of these things. I mean, you can even look at not even just savings, but something as simple as a recoverable. You've calculated an overpayment of $100,000 against a provider. Do you count that whole $100,000 as a savings or as a recovery? Because usually you get about 10 cents on the dollar by the time the provider is done paying. You only get about 10% of it actually back into the program. Do you count the actual money that comes back, or do you count the calculated amount that you determine to be the overpayment? There's no set definition on that. And it gets even more complicated when you're talking about projected savings or amounts, to put to better use. All of those definitions are just all over the board. At the UPIC, we had the authority to work with CMS to revoke providers, which means kick them out of the program for 3, 5, 10 years. So when it comes down to savings on that, how do you calculate that? Do you do the entire time of the revocation time multiplied by how much they got paid the last year that they were doing it? Do you do it for a year? Do you do it for 3 years? It was all over the board on how the UPICs were defining those things.
And yeah, that's a huge challenge. And, we had for about a year, we brought a bunch of our plan SIU leadership in, and we brought in some plans that we just have connections to that we do ad hoc work for and things of that sort. And we had a working group, right, for about a year, mm-hmm, on some of these issues. And the one thing that we thought was really interesting that came out of our working group was every plan's methodology was just a little different. And I think the important thing for people to understand is it's not, your methodology is not wrong if you're using some empirical analysis on how you're doing it, right? And, we find that even smaller plans have some methodology in place as to why they consider their methodology to be correct for them, right? Different plans are going to have different methodologies. And I think you've got to have whatever you're doing as your savings projection, you've got to have a methodology that you can stand up to and articulate properly, you know, on some of these things. You know, is it based upon build amounts? Is it on paid amount? Is it on a new edit? Is it on whatever it may be? You've got to have a methodology, and you've got to be able to articulate how you've come to that methodology. And I think if you had 10 plans in a room and you asked them each how they calculate savings, you're probably going to get 10 different responses, because everybody's going to have a different methodology on how they do that. I think that's probably the biggest challenge in the payment integrity space is consistency from plan to plan. There really isn't any when it comes to those things. But certainly, you know, as we've all talked about, and Wade, I want to go to you, the last piece of this is when at least from a managerial perspective, categorizing the kinds of cases that your team is working on in broad strokes, right? Is it a service is not rendered? Is it upcoding? Is it misrepresentation? Is it whatever it may be in the pharmacy space? Is it generic substitution? Is it whatever it is? Understanding the category, understanding, you know, maybe a little bit about what that individualized scheme is, and then understanding, you know, how you got your overpayment or where it ended. Those are great tools from a managerial perspective in being able to understand what are the kinds of fraud, waste, and abuse schemes that your plan is seeing, right? It's a great tool to be able to understand how to put resources to the right things.
Yeah, and I think it also helps you understand if you categorize them as such, there might be a certain type of case, whatever it is, that is going to require much more resources to work through to some kind of resolution. Whereas others, I know one type of case that one of the plans was doing was a lot of these electronic visit verifications. And you can basically just, it's like an automatic electronic check-in for home health visits. And they're very easy cases to work because you get this printout, and a lot of times it's just the home health aide is not licensed. So all those visits are overpayments. But a case like that, it's very easy to work like with a broad stroke and come up with an overpayment as opposed to something that's going to take, you know, on the other extreme, it's going to take, you know, undercover work, and, you know, it's just a lot more resource intensive. So from a managerial position, you kind of want to look at those two as to, because you can't work all of them, you're going to have to, you know, draw the line on some of the cases. So if you know which ones are going to bring you your most ROI with the least amount of resources, maybe that's something that takes a priority over the other types of cases. You know, notwithstanding, obviously, you have to look at patient harm and things of that nature. But if one certain category, you can run through those cases and bring them to resolution much easier than another type of case, maybe you need to, you know, focus your attention on the ones that are easier and quicker and have the highest return, basically.
Yeah, I mean, similar to prioritizing cases based upon information that you receive and the viability of the case, you know, there's always that opportunity. If you're seeing, for example, a lot of cases involving one type of provider specialty or a particular code, you know, maybe you decide, hey, we're not going to be working on some of these kinds of cases because they're more technical violations, and we're going to focus on some of the cases that involve, you know, when we start seeing, for example, like a lot of cases involving skin substitutes or something along those lines, you know, a new device comes out and things of that sort. So that, you know, understanding where those cases kind of fit in that pecking order helps with some of those case reprioritization, things of that sort. So yeah, it's an important piece, but I think part of it is that in some instances, particularly the smaller plans out there, you know, we hear a lot from the smaller plans that kind of get ignored in the SIU space and the payment integrity space, which is why we really like to focus on the small and medium plans, because they deserve a lot of attention as much as any of the BUCAs that are out there deserve. And we find that oftentimes there's the biggest challenge with these smaller plans is policing themselves, right? Policing their ability to police their network. And while they can't have something like an APS, there are obviously some publicly available tools out there that may be at low cost or free and things of that sort, where it's just a matter of just spending the time to find those websites and those tools, some of that open source intelligence that's out there, culling together a list of and bookmarking or creating a spreadsheet of the relevant sites that providers are, you know, information is going to be found. So, you know, no one is saying that you have to invest tens of millions of dollars like APS does, which, by the way, APS only covers Medicare and Medicaid. And so commercial payers have to have their own credentialing tools to get out there. I always thought it would be an interesting thing if APS was opened to commercial payers where they could pay a fee to get a subscription to something like APS to run through to run providers through this the APS system, even if it's just a matter of going in and being able to pull a report, because APS is a reporting tool. So to be able to go in, plug a provider's name, and I think that would be an interesting premise to be able to capture information on the commercial side that is already being captured on the CMS side and then offset the cost. Right. But, you know, I guess there's probably a bunch of legal and regulatory things out there that prevent that from happening. So I think this is like it's the payment integrity wish list. So what are your thoughts? If you're one of the people that's a regular watcher or listener to our podcast, what are your thoughts on that, on something like an advanced provider screening tool in the commercial space where maybe even the commercial payers get together and create their own database that mirrors APS? There's no secret sauce on the tools that APS is tackling through what they call an API and some of those databases. So what are your thoughts? We'd like to hear about that. So it's good stuff. I mean, keeping the bad providers out is an important piece. Maintaining the good providers in the network is just as important. So let's see what people think about that. Good seeing you guys, as always. To our viewers, our listeners, thanks again every week for tuning in. Check out the website. I keep saying the new refreshed website looks really good. Our sales and marketing team put together an amazing new refreshed website. You can sign up for the newsletter right through the website. When you get on there, there's a splash screen. Get the newsletter every week to your inbox. You're going to see here in a couple of weeks, we've got a great LinkedIn Live. I'll be speaking with Stephen Bittinger, a lawyer with a firm called K.L. Gates. He works out of Charleston, South Carolina. Great lawyer. Spent a lot of time with him. We're going to be talking about statistical sampling, overpayment estimation. We're talking about the PIM. Everybody loves the PIM. Program Integrity Manual. We're going to be talking about Chapter 8, a little bit of Chapter 3. Everybody's going to be getting their statistical sampling geek on if you're a statistical sampling geek. And we're getting ready for a bunch of other really good LinkedIn Lives coming up through the summer. So as always, thank you for signing up for those. Thanks for getting our newsletter. Thanks for participating in our weekly OIG Roundtable. And as always, we'll see you guys next week on the next OIG Roundtable.